dreams. Come join me and have your mind blown. I thank you.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Criminal conspiracy between News International and Scotland Yard at the heart of government. While the perpetrators remain at large, it undermines the rule of law. But way back in 2000, two investigative journalists in the Guardian Investigation Unit were digging out stories of police corruption. But they were forced to leave the paper because the editor couldn't print the stories. The editor caved in to pressure from the very police force they were investigating. These shocking revelations were finally published as a book, The Untouchables, Dirty Cops, Bent Justice and Racism in Scotland Yard, back in 2004. And I got the two authors' take on the hacking scandal yesterday. Plus, we have 60 million acres of land in Britain and around about 60 million people as well. But over the centuries, it's been robbed from the many by the few. And now, most of us don't have any land at all. Even if you've got a mortgage, I'm afraid it's actually the bank that owns your land. But the greedy landowners' days are numbered. Frank White and friends are going to be reclaiming the fields next weekend. And Frank White is joining me now. Hi, Frank, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Okay, now 60 million acres, 60 million people, why is it that we have this imbalance? And actually most of us have got no land at all. Maybe a little allotment that we rent from the council.
Well, I think you know better than I do that, yeah, a small number of people own a vast amount of land in this country. And yeah. In the future, we're going to have to change that because we're going to have to rely on ourselves to provide food. So
anyway, what are you planning for next weekend? What's the big idea?
Well, I'm involved with a network called Reclaim the Fields, and we're having a gathering in Bristol. So everyone's getting together and we're going to talk about these issues and about how we can have a post-capitalist strategy to take advantage of whatever problems we might face in the future to take control of food production.
So Martin, I can see your eyes flicking away there and your sort of face smiling. Could you tell us, I mean, this is a real thing we need, isn't it? We need some kind of strategy. As Britain's industries are run down, we heard last week about the Derby train factories aren't going to be making thousands of people redundant because the production is moving elsewhere. Britain isn't really a heavyweight industrial economy anymore, is it?
Well, I don't think we want to write off the industrial sector of the economy because we want land reform. I mean, land reform we do need, I absolutely agree. I was doing a PhD thesis about land reform in Poland, actually, but I didn't complete it at Glasgow University. And one of the things that I was keen to stress in what I was saying is that land reform, particularly in poor countries, is not an alternative to industrialisation. It is the path to industrialisation. If you look at countries like Japan, like China, like South Korea, the first step on the road to being a modern industrial economy is land reform. You've got to break the power of the feudal landowners, you've got to redistribute the land, and then you've got people stabilised, and you can then draw them into an industrial economy bit by bit as you require them, with a stable situation for your peasant farmers. Now, that is in fact the only way that people have ever managed to modernise their economies. So to my mind, a back to the land movement is not necessarily nostalgic, it's the future, and it's got to be linked to high tech in your industries as well. We don't want to get rid of high tech industry just because we're going to have land reform. We want both.
Now, Bristol has high-tech industry. We do missiles. We build missiles and things like that. Is that really
the wrong sort of high-tech industry?
Anyway, okay, can you tell us just practically, Frank, what's going to be happening next weekend and where?
Well, you can get information about the movement Reclaim the Fields and the gathering at reclaimthefields.org online. But yeah, basically, we're having a session of discussion groups and workshops to do with land rights, seed rights, land reform, like you're talking about.
So what are seed rights? I mean, I have the right to go down to this garden centre and buy seeds, don't I?
Well, yeah. It's like the corporations buying up the genetic material and holding our seeds to ransom. Basically, the genetic material of this earth should belong to all of the people on it, not just a select few who want to make profit out of it.
This is quite weird, isn't it? Because certain companies now actually own genes, which are quite important genes, in these seeds. I mean, how on earth has that come about, Martin?
It's because of what they call trade-related intellectual property rights, TRIPS. They've tried to make it possible to privatise the gene pool. And of course, the seeds that we use have been developed over thousands of years by peasant farmers, our ancestors, and they don't belong to individuals. And this is another privatisation of a collective good, and that is what they try to achieve. I mean, a lot of what goes on in the market economy is in fact just theft, masquerading as enterprise.
Now, I mean, what Frank is saying there is actually kind of contradicting what you're saying about the problem being the feudal system. The feudal landowners aren't the problem in this case, are they? They are the merchant classes and the big corporations.
Yeah, I mean, but what we're talking about is a feudal landowner is a certain kind of a problem. A modern multinational company is another kind of a problem. Both of them don't take any notice of the interests of ordinary people. They never did. And we've never had a democratic society here or anywhere else. I mean, the ordinary people generally are treated as dispensable and not really the important focus of what's going on, and that's always been a problem for generations.
So, I mean, surely there's not really a problem with us getting food, Frank, is there? Because, I mean, certainly if we've got an allotment, we can grow our own food, and actually, food is fairly cheap down at the supermarket, down at Tesco's. Tesco Value potatoes are incredibly cheap, really, even compared to what they were a few years ago. This isn't really that difficult to do, is it? So why do we need to be actually taking control of the food supply when it seems to be working pretty well as it is?
Well, as probably most of your listeners are aware, there's something called peak oil, and apparently after we've reached that problem, then we won't be able to produce food so cheaply, because the value of the food in the supermarket is not the actual value. It doesn't take into account the ecological costs that are encompassed in these cheap foodstuffs. You know, we need to start valuing food more and valuing our environment more, and then people will realize actual value of the food that they eat when it's actually healthy food, or food that's not going to toxify them or cause them to have problems in their psychology.
I mean ultimately this whole thing of land ownership is a bit like a juggernaut, isn't it? It's a massive thing. I mean,
surely relate to all issues in life. Yeah,
but surely by just having a little powwow here in Bristol, you're not going to turn that juggernaut around, are you?
Well, it's not about attacking the juggernaut. It's about doing things now to make sure we lay the foundations for the future solutions to the problems that we're facing. Making sustainable food now, for example, structuring businesses in a different way, making co-ops or community-supported agriculture, CSAs.
So what is community-supported agriculture? How does that work?
Well, it's basically your customers become owners or shareholders of whatever you do. So instead of you...
Isn't that a bit like my Tesco club card? Maybe the co-op, because you do actually have a share in the co-op, don't you? But I mean, most people feel that they want to buy into where they're getting their food from. For some people, that's a Tesco
different
club
things.
Card.
You know, if you're involved in the food growing process and you're an urban person, then you get to be involved in a maybe less urban pursuit. You have a big garden where all these veg are growing. You can come down and help out. You can volunteer, or you can... Usually CSAs have work days or activity days for families to come down, so it offers them a lot more. It's a lifestyle choice that they're offering, as well as reasonably priced healthy vegetables. It's a very good option.
Martin, what are your thoughts about these things like community-supported agriculture? It's not realistic that people are going to volunteer.
It is. I mean, in Japan, these kind of schemes have been running for years and years and years. I mean, I remember going to a conference where this was a revolution led by housewives, is what they used to call it, which was slightly non-PC. But I mean, they've had this stuff for years in Japan, where people buy their stuff directly from farmers, and it's huge. You know, we're talking millions of people involved. The other point I'd make about agriculture is it's all in a distorted market because of things like the Common Agricultural Policy and the massive subsidies that the US gives to their agricultural producers. The US has had a policy since 1945 of subsidizing their agriculture in order to undersell everybody else in the world market, so that they can basically force countries to accept that they're going to eat American food. And that, of course, gives them geopolitical power over those countries. Like Bangladesh, for example, gets more than half of its food from USAID. And, of course, they then under severe pressure to vote for what the Americans want in when it comes to invading Iraq or whatever. I mean, ultimately, the whole of this system is rigged. And if we're going to rig the system, the Common Agricultural Policy rigs the system. I'm not a free marketeer. I believe in rigging the system. Let's rig it for community-supported agriculture, because that's what we want. And it's, it'd be just as efficient as the current setup of building, you know, grain, wine mountains and wine lakes and butter mountains and what have you. I mean, the whole thing is ripe for to be redeveloped.
I mean, how fragile is our food system as it is at the moment? And do you know, is it possible that we can actually grow our own food here in Britain?
Absolutely, yeah. There's an article in a magazine called The Land, which I think is a fantastic magazine. It sets out everything you need to know about the current land policy. I think it's issue 7 or something, the winter issue. Talks about, can Britain feed itself? There's a link to it on a report called Who Feeds Bristol, which is also a very interesting read. And I think Bristol is setting up itself to be a hub for this sort of development and change. And
so,
like,
but what's the answer to the question, though? Can Britain actually feed itself? I know
absolutely
we
yes.
had to. I mean, during the Second World War, I mean, there were the convoys coming from the US, but there was a real massive effort to make sure Britain could feed itself. Could it do so today?
Absolutely. Yeah, I believe 100% that it can. And I think the information in the media that propagates the idea that we can't feed ourselves just enables the corporations or whoever does control the food system at the moment to maintain that control through fear. Or whatever, that people think, oh no, we can't. People will always brush it offhand, you know, like say, oh no, it's not possible, we need all these chemicals, we need to increase food production by 50%, and all this information is totally false. If you take a deeper look into it, it really is possible for us to look after ourselves.
Now, the first stage for most people when they're looking at actually growing a bit of food is not necessarily their garden. Certainly, they, you know, their block of flats, you know, you haven't got anywhere to grow food, is an allotment. How easy is it actually to get hold of an allotment in Bristol?
Well, at the moment, yeah, some areas of the town where there's less demand, you can get allotments. So if you talk to a guy called Steve Clampin at the allotment department in Bristol Council, you can find out some areas where there's a higher demand. Obviously, the waiting list is longer, but things like CSAs, there are places in town which are vacant, and because of this food policy council, they're changing the way that things happen in Bristol. And I think groups like Reclaim the Fields, and probably what comes out of it, will be things like these CSAs where people from housing estates can club together and start growing on larger pieces of land to provide for themselves and their families. Yeah, basically, if you want to get involved in what we're doing, I'd really love you to come along. You can come to the factory in Portland Square on the 6th and 7th of August. We're going to be talking about all these issues, and we can get involved and get busy. Basically, it's a practical alternative, and it's really going to happen.
Okay, and what about these kind of box schemes? Because I remember being on one of those for a while, which was rather nice, because every week you get a box left outside your door which had the kind of seasonal vegetables, so it would change through the year, and it sort of challenges you, like, how are you going to actually cook this thing that suddenly turned up in your box? So are there plenty of those schemes around? And if so, you know, whereabouts do you find
them? Yeah, well, it's a bit of a paradigm shift away from the ready meals in the supermarkets and getting you back into something like the diets we ate, you know, before the war, which were much healthier in a way. Seasonal vegetables are just the best way to go, as fresh as possible. And in a way, box schemes are more or less like a CSA, but with a CSA, it's a development of that relationship between the producer and the grower. Yeah, it's pretty easy to find out about box schemes. You know, well, Riverford is the main one that everybody knows about. But
and whereabouts can you go in town and actually find them? Or do they just sort of swoop in the middle of the night with a box of vegetables?
Yeah, well, because I grow my own vegetables, I'm not too sure about where you find out about box schemes.
So can you just give us the name again, then?
Riverford.
Riverford.
Everybody knows about Riverford.
Okay,
vegetables.
And then your website, and just remind us again where this is taking place.
The website is reclaimthefields.org, so you can get on there and find out about the things that are happening in the UK, but also the Europe-wide connections that Reclaim the Fields has, because it's spreading. The gathering is on the 6th and the 7th of August at the factory in Portland Square, and we're going to be talking about all these issues and making sure that we can take control of the food production.
Okay, that's next weekend, and I still have to pop down and say hello to you. Maybe do an interview or two. Okay, Frank White, thanks very much. And we're going to be talking about the phone hacking crisis, talking to a couple of authors who've been digging out the dirt on Scotland Yard for the last 10 years after some very appropriate music. This one is from June Tabor, and it's A Place Called England.
I rode out on a bright May morning like a hero in a song, looking for a place called England, trying to find where I belong. Couldn't find the old flood meadow or the house that I once knew, no trace of that little river or the garden where I grew. I saw town and I saw country, motorway and sink estate, rich man in his rolling acres, poor man still outside the gate, retail park and burger kingdom, prairie field and factory farm, run by men who think that England's only a place to park their car. But as the train pulled from the station through the wastelands of despair, from the corner of my eye, a brightness filled the filthy air. Someone sown a patch of sunflowers, though the soil is sooty black. Marigolds and a few tomatoes right beside the railway track. Down behind the terraced houses, in between the concrete towers, compost heaps and scarlet runners, secret gardens full of flowers. Lita grows her scented roses right beneath the big jet's path. Bid a fortune for her garden, Eileen turns away and laughs. Rise up, George, and wake up, Arthur. Time to rouse out from your sleep. Deck the horse with sea-green ribbons. Drag the old sword from the deep. Hold the line for Dave and Daniel as they tunnel through the clay, while the oak in all its glory sucks up sun for one more day. Come all you at home with freedom, whatever the land that gave you birth, there's room for you, both root and branch, as long as you love the English earth. Room for vole and room for orchid, room for all to grow and thrive, just less room for the fat landowner on his ass in his four-wheel drive. Money and it is not blood. It's limestone gorge and granite fell. It's weald and clay and seven mud. It's blackbird singing from the may tree, lark ascending through the scales, robin watching from your spade, and English earth beneath your nails. Here's two cheers for a place called England, sore abused but not yet dead. A Mr. Harding sword of England hanging in there by a thread. Here's two cheers for the crazy diggers, though their hour shall come around. We shall plant the seed they saved us, Commonwealth and common ground. For the crazy diggers, now their hour is come around. We shall plant the seed they saved as Commonwealth and common ground.
Mm-hmm.
June Tabor there with A Place Called England.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
Now, the relationship between the police and press can be strained, and the introduction of corporate communications departments right around Britain's police forces means those forces now attempt to control all communication between the press and the police. All interviews, for example, with this show, have to be approved by Avon and Somerset Public Relations Chief. I've made three requests so far to the police for someone to come on this show to answer questions about Easter's Stokescroft disturbances, but each time, request has been turned down, despite the fact that Avon and Somerset Police is a public service funded by the taxpayer. For example, during the Joanna Yates murder investigation last December, ITN were banned from a police press conference because they transmitted a report with criminologist and former police officer Mark Williams Thomas, where he gave his professional opinion that simple forensic examinations appeared not to have been carried out at the scene where Joanna's body was found. Modern forces favour news outlets that report positively on the police, such as the News of the World, and exclude outlets where they think there will be criticism, behaving at senior levels more like a multinational corporation, trying to put a gloss on their public image than a public service. And that is one way that police corruption can be allowed to fester. Well, way back in 2002, the investigative journalists at The Guardian's investigations unit were digging out stories of corruption at the Met, but they were forced to leave the paper because the editor wouldn't print those stories. He was lent on by senior police officers. Their explosive stories were finally published as a book, The Untouchables: Dirty Cops, Bent Justice and Racism in Scotland Yard, in 2004. And I got their take on the hacking scandal yesterday. First of all, Michael Gillard, who now works for Rupert Murdoch's News International.
My name's Michael Gillard. I'm a journalist. The stuff I do is for the Sunday Times. I met Laurie in the mid-90s when we were investigating a missing Mercedes car that had been sold to Adolf Hitler.
And what about the book, The Untouchables? How did you come to write that?
We started our investigation at The Guardian in 1998. I'm in the investigation unit there, and it grew out of that until we left in 2001 and produced a book 3 years later.
As part of that book, you talk about something called the Ghost Squad at Scotland Yard. What was the Ghost Squad?
That was an attempt by Scotland Yard to set up a secret unit within the Metropolitan Police to have a look at how bad their corruption problem was. The only problem with it was that it had no accountability to either the public through the CPS, Crown Prosecution Service, or any other watchdog body. So it was entirely a self-serving secret organisation designed to mitigate the damage of the corruption problem the Yard had since the 1980s.
Surely it must have been at least accountable to the Metropolitan Police Authority.
No, they didn't know about it.
So secret.
Yeah.
Did you have any problems actually getting this book published and getting your work published in The Guardian?
We published a number of articles in The Guardian until they didn't want to publish any more, and that was in part the result of secret pressure being put on the editor by the anti-corruption squad, which led to us resigning in the March of 2001. Matters changed in and around the summer of 2000. After the head of the anti-corruption squad wrote privately to the editor of The Guardian making baseless allegations about us and our dealings with similar people who we were trying to nurture in order to get information about the level of corruption that existed, and also about the failures of the police to tackle it.
One of the fascinating things about the Untouchables book is the way that the cover price is £19, and yet the last time I looked, it's going second hand for something like £350-£400. Why is it such this amazing kind of rarity value for the book?
Well, I think the publisher printed 5,000 hardback copies, but then we fell out with them and didn't go into paperback when we took the rights back. So those 5,000 copies, some of which are in libraries, have gone up in value, and people are stealing from the libraries and then putting them on eBay at ridiculous prices.
So is there any prospect of you republishing the book?
I believe there's some interest in light of the current issues around News International, the Metropolitan Police, and various sort of journalistic methods, that it could come out soon.
That was Michael Gillard speaking to me yesterday. Mark Martin, can I just ask you for a quick comment on this? Because it is a bit worrying, isn't it, when you've got the Guardian Investigation Unit looking into police corruption, and then a letter comes to the Guardian's editor from the anti-corruption squad at the police, and those articles that they've researched are then not printed.
Well, I suppose what they might say is we're investigating these matters and therefore don't print anything about them. But of course, nobody was ever prosecuted, so that doesn't really hold water. I think that, you know, it's pretty obvious that if there is corruption, people will try and protect themselves from being found out, won't they?
The other thing, of course, is what are your thoughts about this relationship between the press and the police? Because that seems to be at the core here. And Andy Coulson is certainly in the frame, this former director of communications at number 10 Downing Street. It seems you've got the government in Downing Street, you've got News International, and you've got also Scotland Yard in the same kind of small, cosy circle. Why is that a problem? Because, I mean, actually, surely it's okay for these people to be socialising with each other.
Yes, but then we want to know exactly what the hell, what's going on, don't we? And we want to see whether any decisions that they take are being influenced by the, you know, the contacts that they've had. I mean, we just need transparency, as Peter was saying earlier. And if that transparency shows, I mean, the prima facie case here is that the police have protected wrongdoing by News International because they were being paid off. Now, frankly, that's illegal. And if people break the law, they've got to expect to be punished. If you can't do the time, don't do the crime, isn't it?
Yes, what we were saying was who polices the police, and do you think that's actually at the heart of this problem?
It's always going to be a problem. As Sir Paul Condon years ago, when he first became head of the Metropolitan Police, gave a press conference and said, well, I have to tell you...
This is in about 1997.
Yes, he said 250 of my officers are corrupt. That's the bad news. The good news is we know which ones they are and we're trying to get rid of them. The police always have to investigate the police. It's a part of their role and their job. Crooked cops are as perennial as bindweed, and they've got to be ripped out every time. But you just have to keep ripping them out.
But it looks like, in this case, certainly it's shown that the process for doing that, it just simply is totally ineffective. These guys who were the untouchables in this book, published in 2004, were still in their jobs up until a couple of weeks ago.
Well, that's right, and therefore you've got to go in with a scythe and scythe away the bindweed, you know. I mean, ultimately, it's an endless task to keep the police straight. It always will be, and it always was. And if you find that there's an awful lot of corruption, then you've got to do an awful lot of investigating. And of course, if people are sent down and punished, there's a deterrent effect involved. You know, if senior people are shown to be corrupt and are punished, that deters the small fry.
Well, the book, The Untouchables, that I mentioned earlier, is co-authored. We heard Michael Gillard just now, but the other writer of it was freelancer Laurie Flynn, and I spoke to him too yesterday.
My name's Laurie Flynn. I'm the co-author of a book about corruption in the Metropolitan Police called The Untouchables. The other author is a younger man called Michael Gillard Jr., who I met, first of all, socially. He's the son of a very good friend and former colleague of mine when I was working at Granada's World in Action program. We got on very well together, and we started to explore what stories we could do together. One of the stories that we picked on was a famous documentary called The Connection, which had won all sorts of prizes, which we both thought was a fraud and a fake. To cut a long story short, we took this project to a friend of mine who was the deputy features editor of The Guardian at the time, and he was amused, interested, and shocked by the outline we gave him, and he commissioned us to go and see if we could nail this down, which we did. This led to Carlton Television being fined £2 million, 15 journalistic prizes had to be returned because the documentary was a comprehensive fraud and fake from beginning to end. The documentary, The Connection, was a film which began in Colombia with a man on film shown swallowing drugs. He was then supposedly in a continuous journey from Colombia to London, where he passed through the airport, it claimed, and then the drugs were sold on a street near your child's school. The only problem was he'd never swallowed any drugs, he didn't make a continuous journey, and the entire film was a lie from beginning to end.
How did you then come to team up with Michael to write The Untouchables back in the early 2000s?
Well, we were working together by this time at Guardian, as well as getting Carlton fined £2 million for its fraudulent documentary. Two of us won a prize in the British Press Award for Scoop of the Year for that particular series of exposés. We liked working together. it's a very good practice in complex investigations to have two brains rather than one brain working on them, and we enjoyed one another's company. We also had another series of stories that we wanted to explore. One of those centered on police officers and police operations that we thought were very dubious indeed and were being very, very poorly managed. And we started to explore those operations and soon came up with a strong resonance for the background of the tragic Stephen Lawrence murder and the persistent failure of the Metropolitan Police to arrest the father of one of the boys who killed Stephen, who was by this time a major league drugs criminal. So we started to explore the background to the failure to arrest this man and soon discovered that there were several other very important unsolved murders in the same police district in South East London, principally the murder of a police informant and drugs criminal called David Norris and the murder of a private detective called Daniel Morgan. The more we dug into this, the more Seamy doesn't even begin to describe how appalling the policing standards were in this part of London. And it seemed that not merely were murders unsolved, but the murder inquiries were deliberately derailed by corrupt police officers. We went from being very popular at The Guardian to being very unpopular at The Guardian, because as soon as we fastened onto these issues, the Met hierarchy at the highest level started working behind the scenes to open up a space between ourselves and our bosses at The Guardian. How they did this was quite simple. The Guardian is a great newspaper, and there are many fine and talented journalists who work on it. But the linkage between all newspapers and all commercial media and the police, particularly the Metropolitan Police, is a very tight and taut linkage indeed. There's a saying, if it bleeds, it leads. In other words, the commercial media are extremely dependent on police contacts, police sources, favours, access to crime scenes. And this granting of favours is orchestrated and has been orchestrated over very many years to create a thoroughly improper relationship between so-called independent journalists and operational police officers. We can now see this coming to the very front of the news 7 years after we published our book, with the extraordinary revelations about the interpenetration of the Yard and the News of the World, where police officers are working corruptly for the News of the World, and lots of ex-News of the World journalists and executives have inserted themselves into the hierarchy of the Yard, and indeed into the hierarchy of British politics at large.
Just before we go off away from talking about the Untouchables, you talked about something called the Ghost Squad as part of that book. Who are the Ghost Squad?
Well, the Ghost Squad was created in Britain in the 1950s, and which was revisited by the Metropolitan Police in the wake of the Stephen Lawrence affair. They are a supposedly secret, sterile corridor of police who investigate corrupt police. The problem is, you cannot really have organizations investigating themselves. This is a preposterous notion that the police are the right people to investigate corruption in the police. Of course, you need police officers and police skills, but above all else in an investigation, you need total independence. Now, the Ghost Squad was a confected illusion of integrity in the 1950s. It failed to root out corruption, and it failed again in the 1990s to root out corruption, as we can now see that there is a widespread corruption in some elements of the Metropolitan Police. And I should say that corruption isn't randomly distributed throughout all police forces. Corruption is a much bigger problem in port cities, Glasgow, Liverpool, London. This is where drugs in particular come in, and drugs have transformed police corruption and taken it from a controllable to an almost unstoppable force, because the amounts of money are at stake. So Following the Stephen Lawrence inquiry, the Metropolitan Police hierarchy, who were as interested in covering up corruption as exposing it, set up a ghost squad. The problem with the ghost squad in the 1990s is the terrible methods that they used, which are now coming back to haunt them. They once again used supergrasses and granted all sorts of favours to criminals, whom they then manipulated, in some cases, into making statements that they couldn't support. By this time, there was proper disclosure of evidence in English criminal trials. And what started to come back and haunt them is the fact that they couldn't be open about what they had to disclose. So they started selectively disclosing things. And this is now coming back to undo many of the convictions. Convictions of corrupt people are no longer standing up because of improprieties in the way that the investigations of the ghost squad were conducted. And indeed, some of the officers in very senior positions in the ghost squad were highly problematic and had been involved in the unpleasant life of very difficult policing stations in London. I should say that being a policeman is not an easy job. It's an extremely hard and difficult job. You have awesome power, but you also have awesome vulnerabilities to favours, to offers of help that are not disinterested in any way. And one of the things that we discovered, well, of course, was that gangsters who wanted to survive as successful criminals were offering up minnows to police officers with whom they had improper relationships, so that there was an appearance of successful policing which was belied by the underlying realities, where actually there were many serious problematic crimes that had not been cleared up and had not been investigated properly.
As I understand it, back in 2004, The Guardian kind of washed its hands of your investigation.
I regret to say that that's true. They censored our work. They had fallen out of love with us. That's their right, although maybe they shouldn't have been in love with us in the first place. But they had decided that we were taking them in areas they did not at that time wish to go to. They did not wish to challenge the compromised integrity of the Met. They wanted, in their own words, to be on the side of the angels. And they imagined that the angels were the problematic hierarchy that we can now see, and which, to its great credit, The Guardian is currently leading the way in exposing. So I take my hat off to the work that they've been doing recently, but it is a matter of ascertainable fact that they lost their bottle when we were investigating these things 10 years ago, and that there were up to 20 stories of police corruption that they decided they did not want us to pursue, and we were ordered not to pursue, which we said at the time, and I repeat now, is a completely unethical and unacceptable instruction to give to any journalist. There are no areas that you cannot investigate. If you have developed these areas, you have obligations to sources, to families of murder victims that have to be discharged. So that led us into a very unpleasant conflict with The Guardian, and we went our separate ways.
Is there a systemic problem with investigative journalists actually finding it really difficult, once they've done their investigations, then to get that investigation into print?
Well, into print and into television, you know, the fine programmes that ITV in particular used to do, Yorkshire TV's wonderful First Tuesday series, that's gone. World in Action is gone. Thames is gone. This Week is gone. Weekend World is gone. The London programme is gone. And there's been no replacement of these programmes whatsoever in ITV. Now, that's not to say that what goes around won't come around again. I have much better hopes now that the ITV will return into these areas. But you need executives of courage, civic purpose and backbone to support investigators. You do need to be willing to conduct a fight, and you do need to be willing to pay the price in terms of executive time, legal bills, if you're going to do these kind of investigations. Now, the simple fact of the matter is that for the last 50 years, really since the end of World War II, crime journalism has been therapeutic narrative telling you what wonderful people the police are, whereas in fact we all know that journalists, police officers, hospital doctors, we're all human beings. Quite a lot of us are bent, some of us are not so bent, some of us try to be proper in our dealings with the world, but we are human, and therefore corruption is a part of every profession. So you have bent journalists, you have journalists who hack phones, who steal information, who burgle people's houses, and you have police officers who are just the same. Now, if you're going to tackle that, you can be sure that your relationships with the most powerful police force in Britain, and arguably the most powerful police force in the whole of Europe, the Metropolitan Police, is going to lead you in problematic directions. And if you don't have sufficient backbone, if you don't have sufficient courage and civic purpose, then you will compromise with these people, because you need their leads, you need their stories, you need their access. That will lead you to mistreat some of your own people some of the time.
Now, isn't it the fact, though, that with TV advertising revenues right down, the advertisers advertising right across hundreds of channels now rather than just four as it was 20 years ago, maybe this kind of investigative documentary, the kind of World in Action that you were working on and the others that you mentioned, are gone for good?
No, I don't accept that at all. They shapeshift and they take place in different arenas, but there's been a whole clutch of outstanding films made initially for the cinema, often. I mean, for instance, I'm thinking of Charles Ferguson's wonderful film about the banking crisis, Inside Job, and there are 20 or 30 really important documentary films that I can think of that have been made outside the televisual system. Now, that's a sad thing, but at least there are people out there trying to do difficult and challenging work. And I believe that this type of journalism will come storming back. And I think that what Nick Davis has done at The Guardian is indicative of the fact that there is a huge appetite among the British people for understanding how their society actually works, rather than how people who are in high positions and who profit from those high positions are telling them how it works. When I try to describe to people what crime journalism is really like, I see most journalists as essentially delivering aromatherapy for the Metropolitan Police hierarchy. They are constantly massaging them, they're constantly building up so-called heroic figures. Well, these heroic figures can have feet of clay, as we are now seeing. The very people who caused us the most damage when we were investigating police corruption are the very people who are at the heart of this News of the World scandal of the Metropolitan Police. And I don't take pleasure in other people's difficulties, but, you know, these people have behaved so improperly for so long that it's very difficult to feel very much sympathy for them now that they're being exposed.
Now, your book was called The Untouchables, and in that book you have a list of what you call the untouchables at the Metropolitan Police, and both Andy Heyman and John Yates are on that list. So can you just tell us, how can a police officer be so secure in their job and at least potentially or allegedly corrupt that they are literally untouchable?
Well, the Metropolitan Police is one of the largest and most powerful single organizations in Britain. It's also an organization which has very strong institutional connections to the intelligence services through its Metropolitan Police Special Branch. They are also the people who have the extraordinarily difficult job of protecting us against terrorist threats, which make people very, very sympathetic to them. But there's another level to this, and people are rightly sympathetic to what honest police officers are doing. It is an inordinately difficult job. But what you have in the Metropolitan Police is a huge, overburdening hierarchy that one very senior police officer from outside the Met told us that the best thing that could be done was most of them should be removed. You'd have a much tighter general staff and a much smaller general staff, and then you would have operational police officers in the various districts. Now, when you have such a big political class in the Met, you also have the opportunity for toadyism, cronyism, and a Masonic influence. and I think that had been an extremely powerful and damaging influence in the Met. And in our book, we explain that there was a serious attempt in the wake of Sir Robert Mark and Operation Countryman and all the earlier investigations into police corruption in the 70s, there was an attempt to break that Masonic-influenced hierarchy by appointing a woman as officer, as head of intelligence in the Met. She was given the job and then removed. She was given the job because she was not part of the circle of toadies, cronies and masons. And then she was removed within a few days. An extraordinary story that has still never been fully reported other than in our book.
The judge who's been appointed for this judicial inquiry, Judge Levinson, does it come as a surprise to you that it turns out that he's rather friendly with the Murdoch family?
Two parties he's been at that we know of, at Matthew Freud, Murdoch's son-in-law's house. Mr. Freud has been offering him free assistance from his PR company. I think that judge should resign immediately. He's not fit and proper to be doing this investigation. He's compromised even before he opens his notebook for the first blank page. I think it's totally unacceptable, that.
Simon Hughes on Newsnight a couple of weeks ago mentioned this whole business of the Freemason connection. And do you think that there is actually adequate checks in place to make sure that there aren't secret Masonic links between people in some of these cases, say, for example, between the judiciary and Scotland Yard and News International?
My knowledge of Freemasonry is somewhat limited, but it is, and it certainly has been, a hugely significant problem in the Yard since World War II, and I've every reason to believe it's still something of a problem. People join organizations for a multitude of different reasons, and people can manipulate secretive organizations for their own ends, and they can protect and promote people who are fellow members of these organizations. I mean, the book Untouchables tells the extraordinary story of the heroic detective Taffy Holmes, who killed himself and virtually got a state funeral as a police hero, who was in fact one of the most corrupt officers that ever donned a Metropolitan Police uniform. Masonry and abusive masonry are at the heart of his story. There is no doubt at all that the protection of the senior officers who had made Taffy Holmes their friend has continued right up until the present day. There are officers deeply compromised by what went on. Taffy Holmes is connected to the unsolved murder of Daniel Morgan, the private detective who was about to become a whistleblower about police corruption. And those officers have been protected and are still being protected from the long arm of the law. And I don't believe that that's appropriate. And until you deal with the problems of the past, you cannot ensure that your large organization is fit for purpose in the present, because the past isn't really the past. The past is walking around with us every day, as we know. You know, we are those 18 or 20 year olds who did what we did when we were 18 or 20, and maybe that was a daft period in our lives. But if you're a police officer and when you're 20 or 24 you become complicit in some corrupt acts, that stays with you all your life. You can be manipulated all your life by other people who know about that. And that's a very, very, very dangerous position to be in when you're in a closed, secretive, semi-militarized organization like the police, who have to be the way they are. They have a horrible job to do, but they also need, above all, more democracy, more accountability, more daylight, more honest journalism to tell the real stories of what police get up to, both in the public interest and against the public interest among that minority who are actively corrupt.
Your book hasn't been reprinted, and yet it's going for sale secondhand on the internet at the moment, as the last time I checked, at £350, a cover price of £19. One would have thought that if you got the book reprinted, you could make a fortune.
Well, from what I understand, the book is coming back into fashion because of the recent shenanigans between the Murdochs and the Yard. What is happening is that people are unfortunately stealing copies of the book from libraries so that they can make money out of them. I think anybody who steals from a library is a first-class scoundrel, but I also think people who are going to close libraries are pretty nearly in the same category. So I would hope that our book would be reprinted pretty soon, and we're going to do our best to ensure it is.
What should be done, in your view, in the light of the exposures of this phone hacking scandal? Is there anything that we can do? Because the judicial inquiry looks to be compromised from the start, and also very few people really trust the Independent Police Complaints Commission to investigate this. So what should we do in order to draw a line under the hacking crisis?
Well, first of all, I'd say that the hacking crisis is part of a much bigger crisis of burgling, stealing information, which doesn't only apply to the press. I think you'll find that there are other areas. People's medical records have been going AWOL, which I find particularly loathsome, but it's common enough. What has happened, there's a wonderful Yiddish saying, the fish rots from the head. And I, in my lifetime, I'm just about to collect my first installment of my old age pension. I'm a leftover from the 1960s. I'm still, in some senses, a revolting student. I'm still the person I was when I was 18 rather than 65. And I think standards have declined. Integrity has declined. Money orientation has become much bigger. Public service has been degraded. And until the public recovers its own poise, its own appetite for protecting public services, protecting the public interest, and moving away from the lunatic privatizations that have been going on, which have involved the privatization of intelligence, policing, prison officers, and God knows what, then we are, in other words, we need political and economic solutions to political and economic problems. The other thing that we need, a much more effective opposition to this. I've just finished reading the late Tony Jute's book, Ill Fears the Land. A quote from Oliver Goldsmith, Ill Fears the Land, to hastening ills of prey where wealth accumulates and men decay. And that beautiful valedictory book of this dying scholar states in the most shining, inspiring prose the need for there to be a much more alert citizenry. What we've got is democracy without enough active citizens, without enough people calling people to account. So the fact that as a result of the hacking crisis, elements of the press have reawakened. The fact that as a result of the hacking crisis, elements of the donkeys in Westminster have suddenly started braying again rather than giving donkey rides is a very hopeful development. Also, I'd like to see much more private use, individual use of the law to hold people to account. These people who are corrupt in public office deserve to be exposed. So more whistleblowing, more people not waiting until the crisis is lapping round their knees, but when it first touches their feet. If you see something going wrong in a hospital, do something about it. Join your union. Complain under the Public Interest Disclosure, the Whistleblowing Act. You know, when you see something going wrong in your bank, do something about it. You know, the right to say no is very, very fundamental to democracy, and going to need a lot of changes to our culture to make it much more democratic. I was on a train the other day with a young kid who's just graduated from university, who's going off to work for an NGO. And he was telling me about what happened to the students on the demonstrations against the destruction of free higher education. I was appalled at what appears to have happened to these youngsters. You know, these are our kids who are being deprived of their opportunities to explore the world of academia without hobbling themselves with debt. And when they protest about it, they get heckled. I mean, I'm quite appalled at what I heard had happened. So I'm always going to be trying to find some story or other that interests me. I am working on several stories of corporate misconduct because that's what's always interested me. My journalistic career started in the construction industry, went through the asbestos disaster, and has followed many other disasters ever since. So you'll be hearing from me in some obscure book that nobody's interested in until the story achieves traction. And it's always great when a journalist's life's work achieves some traction. That's great news.
That was Laurie Flynn there, who's co-author of the book Untouchables, and that was published in 2004, and it's laid the groundwork for quite a lot of the stories that have come out at The Guardian about phone hacking, certainly by identifying some of the officers within Scotland Yard who Laurie alleged to be in one way or another corrupt and untouchable, ungetatable. Martin, do you want to just sum up here, because ultimately this problem with the police, where is it actually going to go? Because I mean, it's not just the police, but it's also a kind of in a way a kind of pact between News International and some corrupt police officers, with Glenn Mulcair, particularly this private investigator, in the middle. Do you think they're going to actually get to the bottom of this? Because we've seen that this public inquiry doesn't look like it's going to go anywhere if this the guy that's running it is a friend of the Murdochs.
Well, I mean, obviously, there's an element of will they get to the bottom of it, or won't they get to the bottom of it? The point I would make is that all criminal acts are criminal acts, and therefore potentially prosecutable. And that goes for Rupert Murdoch, Berlusconi,